This message, titled The Greatness of God from Exodus chapter 20, verse 7, was preached at Winchester Reformed Presbyterian Church in Winchester, Kansas. For more information, visit us at winchesterrp.com.
Well, brothers and sisters, we come again this evening to the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments, which are an expression of God's unchanging moral will. The Ten Commandments that are summarized as the Scriptures teach us, they are summed up by the rule of love. The Ten Commandments, which Christ, in the days of his earthly ministry, obeyed so perfectly and exemplified for his people. The Ten Commandments, the sum and substance of which are written on the heart of every believer by the ministry of the Holy Spirit. The Ten Commandments have always, as we've seen in weeks past, they've always been a part of the basic, most basic understanding of Christianity. The Ten Commandments teaching us and leading us by the blessing of the Spirit to a conviction of our sin, a conviction of our own inability to love God and to love neighbor as we should. And these commandments, which not only by the blessing of the Spirit convict us, but these commandments, which in the hand of Jesus also give to you and give to me, give to Christians direction and instruction for the way in which we are to live our lives. One of the wonderful things about the Ten Commandments is that in many ways, while many of us are familiar with them, the Ten Commandments can be turned, so to speak, and viewed from many different angles. Different angles that help us to appreciate some of the nuance and some of the things that make this law special to us. It might be a bit of a worn cliche, but it is one that resonates here that in many ways, the Ten Commandments are like a diamond. I remember when I was searching for an engagement ring for Rachel. It was the first time I ever went diamond shopping. And one of the tactics of the jeweler was to make sure that whatever diamond I was looking at was viewed from multiple angles, from multiple perspectives where the light could shine on it from one angle. And then the jeweler would turn that diamond so that light could shine on it from another angle. And the totality of it was to give the radiance and the brilliance of the diamond. And again, it's a bit of a worn cliche, but in many ways, that is what we can do with these Ten Commandments. We can turn them this way and learn to appreciate something about them. And then we can turn them that way and we see them in a slightly different light and we gain a new kind of appreciation. And one of the ways to turn these commandments, in some ways, especially the first four, is to see them and to understand them and to appreciate them in the light of what God is and who God is. Because as we come to understand more of what and who God is, the Bible makes clear, even these commandments make clear, as we understand that, we are more and more instructed in how we should respond to God. Well, that's something that stands as maybe a self-evident principle, but one that is worth emphasizing this evening. What and who God is determines our response to him. What and who God is determines how you and I are to worship God. It determines how we are to serve God. If you were to take for an example this evening, the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. Why is that a commandment given to us to inform us how we are to serve and worship God? Well, because God is one. God is one. There is only one God. And because God is one, then brothers and sisters, we are to worship him. We are to serve him as the only true and living God. Or take an example, as we've seen in the second commandment, that we shall not make for ourselves graven images in the likeness of anything in creation by which and through which we worship God. Why is that? Because what is God? God is a spirit. And when I say that this evening, I don't want you to be confused. I'm not thinking primarily there of the third person of the Trinity, the one whom we call the Holy Spirit, but that God in and of himself, God is spirit. God is not a physical being. God is not made up of parts. God is not a physical creature with a body and appendages like you and me. He is spirit. And so that informs us then how we are to worship him. We are to worship him in spirit. We are not to measure him by creation. We are not to worship him through creation. The what and the who of God, brothers and sisters, determines how we are to respond to him. And I turn these Ten Commandments to that angle this evening because I want you to keep that in mind as we come to the third commandment. The third commandment, as we've read it from verse 7, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." The oneness of God informs us that we are to worship him alone. God being spirit informs us that we are to worship him in spirit. And this third commandment, brothers and sisters, can I put it this way? This third commandment is predicated, it is built upon the greatness of God. The greatness of God. Because God is great. Brothers and sisters, our response to him, in the things that we think about him, in our attitude toward him, in the words that we speak about him and to him, because God is great, all of those things need to reflect that we have an understanding and a comprehension that God is great. And tonight, this evening, in a bit of an introductory way, I want to introduce you to the third commandment. And to do that by meditating for a few minutes this evening on the theme of the greatness of God. Because, brothers and sisters, we will never appreciate the significance of the third commandment until we come to grasp something of the greatness of God. Nor will we appreciate the severity of the warning in this verse if we do not come to terms with how great God truly is. And so with that in mind, I want to think about this. I want to introduce the third commandment this evening under 2 points. The first will be a great deficiency. And my second point this evening will be a great God. A great deficiency and a great God. And so I want to begin this evening as we think about this, as we come to this third commandment, I want to begin with a word about a great deficiency. And when I say that this evening, I don't want you to think that I'm being unnecessarily pessimistic. I don't want you to think that in the things that I'm saying this evening, I'm being unnecessarily cynical. But what I want to do, if the Spirit is willing, is to give an honest diagnosis. That there is, in many of our minds and in many of our hearts, there is a great deficiency in the way in which we understand God. You know, if you look at our society and you look at our culture around us, we live in a day and age that without question and without doubt minimizes God. We live in a culture and we live in a society that has dragged God down, so to speak, from an exalted position to not merely an equal among us, but we live in a culture and we live in a society that has, in a very real sense, put God under our feet. To trample upon him, to challenge him, to blaspheme him, to regard him as something that is completely insignificant. And when we look at culture and we look at the society around us, that shouldn't surprise us. Because we live in a foolish culture. We live in a foolish society. And we say, we sing with the psalmist, it is the fool who says in his heart, there is no God. And that's our culture. That's our society. Lost in their folly, God is someone to be trampled upon. But the real tragedy, brothers and sisters, the real tragedy does not lie in how our culture regards God. The real tragedy does not lie in the way in which our society minimizes God. The real tragedy is that far too often that same attitude has crept into the church. My diagnosis is simply this. That the church today, on the whole, Christians today, on the whole, and if you can tolerate a challenge, perhaps our own minds and in our own hearts, the diagnosis is this: there is a deficiency in many of our comprehensions about God, a deficiency to grasp truly the greatness of God. And in one sense, we might almost throw our hands up and roll our eyes at such a diagnosis, because it seems like such low-hanging fruit. In one sense, brothers and sisters, what person, what man, what woman, what child could ever really come to adequately grasp the greatness of the one whom himself says, my ways are not your ways, my thoughts are not your thoughts? Who among us can actually adequately grasp the one of whom it is said, yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. You are exalted as head above all. So in one sense, to say that all of us have this deficiency, I understand in one sense it might be seen as low-hanging fruit. But this evening I don't mean it in those terms. I don't mean that, generally speaking, because we are finite and because we are creature, that we fail to grasp the greatness of God. What I mean this evening is that too many in the church, and let me be very personal, perhaps too many of us, of you and me, perhaps too many of us are content with a minimal and minuscule and low view of God. A.W. Tozer, if you know the name, Tozer was a phenomenally eloquent preacher. A man who in his own generation sought with all the strength of his ministry to force upon the Church of Jesus Christ, and broadly speaking, on evangelicalism, a man who summoned the whole of his ministry seeking to restore to the church a faith-induced vision of the greatness of God. A.W. Tozer once very pointedly said this 70 years ago, that the God of most Christians today is not the real God. He went on to say, he is not the God of heaven, He is not the God of creation, but he is a handmade God, a homemade God that you can pull down from heaven. And his scathing indictment was to say, this is the attitude that has settled not on culture, not on society, but at the church at large, the minimization of God. And we have to ask ourselves this evening, we have to ask ourselves reflectively, is that true? Is that true here? Is that true of me? Is that true of the way I think about God? Is that true of what I know about God and believe about God? And again, brothers and sisters, I'm not seeking to be pessimistic here. But I am afraid. I'm very afraid for myself and for others that the God of the average Christian and the average church, the God we profess to be true, is not seen and appreciated as one who is truly great. But he has been tamed, and he has been domesticated, and he has, in the words of Tozer, he has been pulled down from heaven to be in the least on an equal footing with us. And I am afraid, brothers and sisters, that perhaps what is missing in so many churches today is the awe of the transcendence of the greatness of God. Tell me this evening, brothers and sisters, does your attitude of God reveal that you know him to be a great God? Do the words that you speak demonstrate the words that you speak about God and the words that you speak to God? Does it demonstrate that you understand that God is great? Does your worship, do your prayers, do your praises inevitably lead yourself and others to the conclusion that the God of this woman or the God of this man is a God who is supremely great? Or could it, brothers and sisters, this evening, could it be asked of you, where is the Lord? Where is the Lord, the God of Moses, who was present in the flashes of lightning and the rumble of the thunder, who himself was manifest in the smoke and the fire that consumed the mountaintop? Could it be asked of you this evening, brothers and sisters, in the way that you speak of God and your attitude and the way that you think about him, where is the Lord? Where is the Lord, the God of Job? The God who exalts himself in the presence of Job as the God whose wisdom gives the eagle flight, as the God who gives to the eaglets blood to suck from the dead carcasses. That's how God chooses to magnify the greatness of his name. The God of Job who declares over all of creation that it is his, and it is he who gives to the lion and to the cheetah the prey to hunt. The God of whom we see but the outskirts of his ways, but as we read in Job, the thunder of his power, who can understand? Could it be asked of you this evening, where is the Lord, the God of Isaiah, who found himself utterly undone when he stood in the presence of the holiness of the triune God and under the echoing chorus of the cherubim who cry unceasingly, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty." Could it be asked of you, where is the Lord, the God of Ezekiel, who even at a passing glimpse of the likeness of the image of the glory of God fell on his face? Where is the Lord, the God of Nahum, who declares that his ways are in the whirlwind and the storm, who by his feet create the clouds as dust? Where is the Lord, the God of John, who beholding a sight of the resurrected Christ fell down as though he were dead? Where is the Lord, the God of Paul, who exclaims to the young pastor Timothy that with him and with God alone is immortality, the God who dwells in unapproachable light? Where is the Lord, the God, who should so manifest his presence here when we worship, that Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, when an unbeliever comes into your midst, they will fall down and they will say, "Surely God is in this place." Where, brothers and sisters, in our thoughts and in our attitudes and in our words, where is that God? I do not mean this as a simple note of cynicism and pessimism, but I do think it is a right diagnosis that too many of us, far too many of us, have a great deficiency in understanding and comprehending something of the greatness of Jehovah. And the third commandment, what is written here for us, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain." This is a command, brothers and sisters, that will seem to mean nothing if we do not grasp something of the greatness of God. There is a great deficiency. But secondly, then this evening, and maybe a little more to the point, I want to preach a word on the great God. To do as I can, trusting in the Bible's own efficacy, to preach something of the greatness of God. You know, it was interesting, as I was thinking about this message and paging through the scriptures, thinking upon the greatness of God, I was struck this week at how often the greatness of God comes in as a primary theme and a primary subject, especially in the prayers and the praises of the gathered assembly of God's people. What do I mean by that? Well, Deuteronomy 32 is an example. Maybe you remember in Deuteronomy 32, Moses addresses the people. We read in Deuteronomy 32 that he addressed the whole assembly of Israel. And he spoke the words, we are told. He spoke the words of a song, that song that has been known throughout the generations of the church as the Song of Moses. And in Deuteronomy 32, verse 4, as Moses speaks the words of his song to the assembly, Moses bids the people of Israel with this simple command, "Ascribe greatness to our God." Ascribe greatness to our God. In 1 Chronicles 29, again, we read there that David, not Moses, but this time David, David blessed, we read, the Lord's assembly. And in the blessing that David speaks to the Lord's assembly, David says this, yours, O Lord, is the greatness. Solomon, in 1 Kings chapter 8, at the dedication of the temple, praying at that moment where the house had been built for the Lord, and all that that meant for the people of Israel and what that actually meant for the nations abroad. And in 1 Kings 8, verse 42, Solomon says, Solomon prays, they shall hear of your great name. Nehemiah, at the restoration of the temple and the confession of the sins of Israel, in Nehemiah 9, verse 32, prays, now therefore our God, the great and mighty and awesome God. Again and again, those are but a few examples. But again and again, we see that in our prayers and in our praises, brothers and sisters, in our prayer and in our praise, we are to make known the greatness, the magnitude, the majesty of God. And what we are to do in our praise and in our prayer, I want to give some time to preach this evening. To preach to you the greatness of God. And of course, time escapes us to be able to make a full statement of the greatness of God. But I want to suggest two directions to think of God's greatness. The first direction, we might say, is God's inherent greatness. God's intrinsic greatness. Greatness. And what I mean by that, and what the scriptures mean by that when they focus their attention on that, is that God, brothers and sisters, God is not merely great for what he does. God is great for what he is. And what is God? The greatness of God is his self-existence. God does not owe his existence and his origin to any. He is not derived from, he is not contingent upon any. He is the self-existent one. Paul says in Acts chapter 17, verse 25, he has no need of anything. His existence is not dependent upon any or on anything. He is in need of nothing. Or as the Apostle Paul ascends to those heights in Romans chapter 11, for from him and through him and to him are all things. His greatness, the greatness of God is his self-existence. The greatness of God, brothers and sisters, is his eternity. Psalm 90, verse 2, a psalm that many of you have grown up singing. Before mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. He is eternal. He is from everlasting to everlasting. And as creatures that are bound by time, to grasp something of the eternity of God is incomprehensible. God's greatness is his infinitude. He is without limits. Psalm 147 says, verse 5, his understanding is infinite. It is without prescription. It is without limits. It is without boundaries. He is the limitless. Brothers and sisters, our God is the limitless God. He is without limits in his knowledge. And so we say that he is omniscient. He knows all things. He knows the end from the beginning. He is limitless in his presence. He is not circumscribed to a room. He is not circumscribed to a specific place and spot. He is, as we say, and as we've learned since we were children, he is the omnipresent one, everywhere present. He is without limits. He is without limits in his power. There is nothing in the will of God that God cannot accomplish. He has power to do it, and so we say he is the omnipotent one. He has all knowledge. He is present everywhere. His power is limitless, and this is his greatness. His greatness is, brothers and sisters, it is his immutability. He is not one who changes, which is hard even there for us to grasp because we're surrounded by change. Everything in our life changes. But God glorifies himself in Malachi 3:6. I, the Lord, do not change. I am what I am, and I only am at all times what I am. The immutability of God. And we could go on and we could go on this evening, brothers and sisters, in all the perfections that are God. It is a demonstration. It is testimony to the greatness of who he is in and of himself, regardless of anything he does. And the testimony of Scripture stands to bear witness to this, that in his greatness, brothers and sisters, God is wholly other. He is not us. And he cannot be brought down to our level. He cannot be placed under our feet to be trampled upon. He is the great God. That's just one angle to consider the greatness of God. There is also, if I can put it this way this evening, not only an inherent and an intrinsic greatness to God, there is also a revealed greatness. There's a revealed. That what God is, God has made known to us. That what God is, God has chosen to reveal to us what he is. What God reveals concerning himself, brothers and sisters, what God makes known about himself actually communicates to us, even if very dimly, it communicates to us something of what God is. And God has revealed his greatness. He's revealed it in creation, in speaking all things into existence out of nothing, as a demonstration of his eternity and his wisdom and his power, as Paul says in Romans chapter 1. He has revealed his greatness not only in creation, but he has revealed his greatness in redemption. In the salvation of sinners, in not leaving us in our estate of sin and misery, but determining according to the counsel of his own will for the praise of his glory, to save his own through the Redeemer, Jesus Christ. And ultimately, the greatness of God is revealed in Jesus. In Titus 2, Christ is called the great God. In Hebrews chapter 2, verse 3, The salvation that Jesus brings is a great salvation. In Hebrews 4:14, he is a great high priest. In Hebrews 10:35, he is our great reward. In Hebrews 13:20, he is the great shepherd. All that is God. All the greatness that is God is revealed to us in the face of Jesus Christ. And that becomes significant. That becomes really important when we come to this third commandment. Because the third commandment says, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain." The name of God. You know, when we name our children, sometimes we just name them Y because we like the sound of it. We like the sound of this name. We like the sound of that name. Sometimes we name them in remembrance and in memory of loved ones and of friends and family members. But as we will see, if the Lord is willing, the name of God does not operate in that way, but the name of God, the name of God, the singular name of God, is the very revelation. It is the self-disclosure of the greatness of God. His name reveals to us what he is in all his greatness. And the third commandment bids us that we shall not take that in vain. In our thoughts, in our attitudes, in our words, we are not to vainly treat the greatness of the great God. As I said, I'm only engaging you this evening to introduce you to this commandment, to introduce you to the thrust of what God's law asks of us in not taking his name in vain, but with mind and heart, by faith and by reason, to know and to comprehend the greatness of God, and to ask ourselves, do my thoughts and my attitudes, do my words, do my praises, do my prayers make known the greatness of who he is? Let's pray.